Okay, I guess we can get started. It's one more minute. I'm David Alkeck. I'm acting president of this society. The Dallas Philosophers Forum has been in existence for 40 years or so.
Over 40.
Over 40 years.
44?
No.
I don't know if you remember that. 42 or 44.
This is our president and professor emeritus, Bob Berman. He's from the very beginning of this thing. He put it together. We have academic types to talk to us, but not necessarily academic types. And it's not always about philosophy, sometimes about science and art and literature. And we even had the poet laureate of Oklahoma speak to us. Anyway, tonight we're going to have, first of all, some little housekeeping. Make sure you pay your entry fee to Mr. Drum, David Drum here, if you haven't already. We do have our expenses. Philosophy isn't free. we've set up a scholarship fund too for philosophy students. And make sure you pay your bill. Don't let us get stuck with it. And take care of your server. And we're going to have a Q&A afterward. And please, when you ask a question, don't go into a long tirade and give a lecture. Make it in the form of a question, if you can, please, so that everybody will have a chance. All right. Do we have some first timers here? Where did you hear about us?
My lovely friend, Kate.
Okay.
I think she's been coming for a little while.
Very good. I'm glad, and come back. Yes. Where did you hear from us?
From a website called meetup.com.
Oh, meetup? Good, okay, good. Well, tell your friends. I hope you enjoy tonight. Okay. Anything else I've forgotten, David?
I think that covers it.
All right. our speaker tonight, Tom Perryman, he gave me his resume, two pages long. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but what was missing was where he was born. So I said, Tom, where were you born? He said, Baylor Hospital. Mother Baylor Hospital. He's a native Dallasite. Can you believe it? I mean, one of those rare entities. Welcome, Tom. Tom went to Green Hill School, where he got his high school diploma, 1981, went to Northwestern, where he's got his BA and MA in English, to McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago, and to SMU for another master's degree. From 85 to 1999 and from 2001 to the present, you've been at Green Hill. He's the assistant headmaster there. You still teach English, I understand, upper school. He oversees recruitment and hiring of all teaching faculty and administrators, and is the de facto dean of faculty there at Green Hill. Married with two stepsons, and co-authored a book, From Humble Beginnings, the First 50 Years of Green Hill School. So Tom is going to speak to us tonight on growing a new generation of social justice activists and agitators. That ought to be very interesting in our present political climate. So without any further ado, Tom Perryman.
On? Yeah. Thank you. I'm very, very excited to be here tonight. one of my teachers growing up here in Dallas, and frankly, a hero of mine, Skip Kilmer, is a part of this organization. And Skip asked me if I would come and talk about my most recent journey, my most recent learning journey. And when one of your old teachers asks you to do something, you do it. I first had Skip in 1974, but he will always be my teacher in many ways. And I'm disappointed that he is gallivanting in New Mexico, I believe, house sitting for somebody out there, and he's not here. But I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm humbled to be among this group. I am not a philosopher. I am not an expert in anything. I am a lifelong student, and I just want to tell you about my journey. And if that is of interest, then we've hit on something. I was born and raised in Dallas. There aren't a whole lot of us left anymore, but I was born here to two well-educated parents. My father is a physician. So I grew up in Richardson in a privileged household. Education was very, very important to my family from the time I was a little bitty. And so my parents, when I was three, went looking for a school that they felt like would offer me and my three brothers more than what the neighborhood school was able to offer in Richardson. And so they came upon this little school out in the sticks called Green Hill School. It was literally a farm in Addison, Texas in those days. I remember when I first got there, it was 1967, and there were farmhouses and nothing around anywhere. No impressive facilities whatsoever, but there was really amazing education on there. Things were shaking and baking even back in the late 60s at Green Hill, and I felt very, very fortunate to be raised in that kind of environment around teachers who inspired me and challenged me and loved me. And that is important as a student. Everybody's important today as it was then. When I graduated from college, I had no idea what I wanted to do, and the head of school asked me if I would come teach middle school English. And so I came and began my teaching journey in 1985, having no idea what I was doing, walking into a sixth grade classroom, but falling in love in the first 3 months with the idea of rolling up my sleeves and learning with 11-year-olds. There's not much that could be more enjoyable than that. And I had that journey for 5 years before my head of school came calling again and started nudging me towards administration, asked me if I would be head of lower school. And I told him I would do it on one condition, and that was that I always be allowed to teach a class. If I was going to be an administrator that was no longer a teacher, I was not going to be an administrator. That would, all the joy would be forfeited. I had no desire to go down that road. So he allowed me to start teaching an upper school English class at that time. And I was worried that kids growing up at Green Hill and kids growing up in this area were not learning their region, didn't know their roots. And so I created a course that I call Literature of the Southwest and began bringing to them curriculum that was far outside the typical Western canon of literature, but literature that I felt like was important. If you were going to grow up in Dallas, you needed to know where you came from. And so I had a chance to begin to develop my own curriculum. And all right. So about 1999, as a 36-year-old seeker, I began to wonder what I needed to be doing. What was my purpose? I loved working at the school, but I needed to find something different. I happened to be a big fan of Frederick Buechner, who is a theologian. And Buechner spoke to me in a way that really made a lot of sense. And so I decided that I was going to go to seminary. I was going to go wrestle with the world's really tough questions. I had no desire whatsoever to find a pulpit. I had a desire to wrestle with hard questions. And I picked a seminary in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago, a Presbyterian seminary, that was unlike almost any seminary in the country, certainly in the Presbyterian church. It was one where, for the first time in my life, I was a minority in every demographic. There were more women than men. There were more people of color than white people. There were even more non-Presbyterians at the Presbyterian seminary than there were Presbyterians. And so it was an opportunity on the south side of Chicago, a wonderfully gritty area, to learn and wrestle with things that made my soul sink. Had no idea what I was going to do with it. I had sold the house. I had walked away. Didn't think I was ever coming back to Dallas. But this was 2 years that just felt tremendously revitalizing for me. While I was gone, however, the school had a change of leadership. A new head of school came in. It happened to be a fellow that I had met before, who was coming in from Virginia. And he called me and asked me if I would come home. That in taking over this school that I knew so well from 14 years as an employee and 15 years as a student, he said he needed me back. And so I decided that my ministry was going to be in a coeducational, non-sectarian, non-uniform school. That my ministry was working with kids in a classroom. And so he convinced me to come back. I'm going to take a minute, if I may please, to brag on my school. Because I'm very, very, very blessed to teach at a place that really nurtures the individual within the larger community. Greenhill is not the kind of school that cranks out a certain kind of kid. It's the kind of school that takes interesting, engaged, involved kids and lights a fire under them. And that's a real privilege. When I talk to teaching colleagues around the country who teach in different environments, that is not most teaching gigs these days in 2016. It is a real privilege to be able to do that. Greenhill, when it was founded in 1950, before Brown v. Education, by the way, this is not a white flight school, established financial aid to make sure that there was socioeconomic diversity before there was a budget, which wasn't exactly the wisest business model. And they realized very quickly that four of the founding faculty members were going to have to go without a salary to make it work. But that was at the core of the school's mission, that we're going to make this work whether it's practical or not. In the 1960s, Greenhill actively went out and recruited students of color long before DISD and the surrounding public districts were practically integrated, certainly. Brown v. Board had legally integrated them, but that wasn't, in fact, going on. That was part of our mission from way back when. In 1973, we formed a partnership with the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Dallas, which since has become a model for independent schools all over the country to identify students that can benefit from the education and do whatever it takes to get those kids to the school and make that workable from a transportation standpoint and also from a financial aid standpoint. Greenhill in 2002 became the first independent school in the Southwest to integrate sexual orientation into its non-discrimination lingo, and a couple of years ago became the first independent school in the Southwest to sign the Charter for Compassion, which, if you're not aware of that, is something that definitely is worth looking into. About 10 years ago, the folks at SMU, at the Emory Human Rights Program, sought us out because they felt like Greenhill was the school in the area that was most sort of spiritual brothers. With their mission. Their mission is there's no such thing as a lesser person. If you have not met Rick Halperin, I hope that you get a chance to meet Rick Halperin someday. He is one of the most amazing Pied Pipers and one of the real scholars and leaders in human rights work in this country today. SMU, I believe, still has the only human rights degree program west of the Mississippi, one of only five or six in the entire country. They're working on, I believe next year, their master's in human rights comes online, and in a couple of years, the doctoral program will come online. So Rick's seeking us out was a real watershed moment for me, because I miss being a student. I had been back for 10 years, and I miss being in the classroom. And so I decided to jump in and go to school at SMU's Embry Human Rights Program, where I just finished this past year and had a really, really remarkable program. So I mentioned to you that I had taught for a long time my course on literature and history of the Southwest, and then had been talked into adding a survey of poetry class. But in both of those classes, I began to itch and yearn for more than just the literature curriculum. I wanted to bring more to it. I realized that as I was exposing kids to Texas history, that if you study the Texas Revolution, in fact, you will find an awful lot of evidence that it was a land grab, quite illegal in its roots. The Texas Rangers are hardly the bastions of glory that they have been cracked up to be in Ranger hagiography through the years. There was a lot about Texas history that wasn't getting taught. Furthermore, as I taught my poetry class, I was coming across these extraordinary poems whose intent was not just to entertain and give you a lovely picnic reading under the trees, but poetry that was meant to get under your skin and make you mad and make you want to do something. And so I started thinking, okay, how can I make all of this coalesce and do something with it? I came across this guy, Jerry Mitchell, and I'll just put him on there for you. His Twitter handle is @JMitchell. This guy is a reporter in Mississippi, I believe. I got to meet him a couple of years ago. He is constantly uncovering injustices throughout the South. And he shoots out something every day that just is inspiring. Here are just a couple of his pieces of wisdom. He also... If you remember the story of Emmett Till, a young boy in 1955 who was murdered for talking back to, some people say whistling, but his friend said he talked back to a white woman. Mamie Till has this wonderful quote over here, the most germane part being, the murder of my son has shown me what happens to any of us anywhere in the world had better be the business of us all. This is a sign that marks his murder site, and you can see in the last year that if you think our political climate is not getting more tense, look closely at that sign. A real depressing thought, I think. So I decided to create two classes. As I was finishing my program at SMU, I engaged in a capstone project. And I decided rather than do theoretical research, I wanted to do something that I could use. And so I opted to create two classes that, as I was creating them, I was also pitching them to the program committee at Green Hill in the Upper School English Department and History Department. And had them approved, because my goal was to finish my capstone, graduate, and start teaching the classes in August, and I was able to pull that off. I really had two courses that I wanted to create that spun out of the two courses that I had taught before. One of them was just going to be a sort of a catalog of human rights issues in the United States, and the other was going to be using poetry to get at social justice issues. So I decided to entitle this class The American Promise, because if you've never seen LBJ's speech to Congress a week after the Edmund Pettus Bridge incident in Selma. LBJ was far from an eloquent spokesman. But if you watch that speech, that man got after it that day. And what he said reached right into the heart and soul of this country in a way that no president perhaps had ever spoken at that time. And he talked about the American promise. So I decided to title the course The American Promise. It is for juniors and seniors. They can cross-register for it. They can take it as a history class. They can take it as an English class. I found this wonderful quote from Huck Finn, where Jim is talking to Huck, that I just think applies so beautifully. Right is right, and wrong is wrong, and a body ain't got no business doing wrong when he ain't ignorant and when he knows better. So this was the class that I decided to tackle, and I realized that I was going to run into some challenges just in our political climate, depending upon what I chose to tackle. So I opted for three case studies that I felt like high school kids would be interested in, that I had a great deal of interest in myself and had done a lot of research in, and that I felt like I could apply to their lives. But the first thing I needed to do was make sure that we had a common vocabulary and a common set of assumptions to have these discussions, so it didn't slide into political talk. What I didn't want was to get hijacked by some group of kids who objected to something for political reasons. So what I opted to do was take the Universal Declaration of Human Rights from 1948 and use that as the document that would be our benchmark and our yardstick for everything we discussed. We weren't going to talk about this as a liberal issue or a conservative issue, as a democratic issue, as a Republican issue. We were going to look at this as a human rights issue, as articulated by the United Nations in 1948. Is anybody in here familiar with that document? Anybody read that document? A couple of you? 30 really extraordinary articles that I dare you to read and pick a fight with. They serve as a great benchmark. But what came out of this, to start off with the class, was they started asking, yeah, Mr. Perryman, these are great, but are these rules or are these just recommended guidelines? Leave it to a 16-year-old to try and figure out. Is this a rule or is this a guideline? They also wanted to know, where's the accountability? So who enforces it? Sure, we've got a constitution that technically is the law in this country, but when you've got something that we're saying is international and universal, who enforces that? We rolled up our sleeves and had some great, great discussions about that. But on day one, I asked them to all read and sign off on the fact that we're going to use this as our benchmark. And that has taken away any bone of contention throughout the entire trimester. It really has been amazing. I've got kids in there on both ends of the political spectrum, and we haven't had one argument over the basic right of any of these issues. I decided to build the course rather than around what I knew, around their questions. I wanted to feed them rich, interesting reading and videos and literature, documents, movies, plays, and I wanted them to bubble up the questions. It was their job each day to come to class with these essential questions, not plot questions in a novel, but really get at the heart of issues, to bring their curiosities. And that has changed the entire tenor of the course. This isn't what I want them to learn. I'm bringing them things that I find interesting and letting them shape the entire syllabus. And it's really been an awful lot of fun. Keeps me on my feet. My crucial tenets in putting together this class was, first of all, I wanted it to be absolutely relevant. If you've got a 16-year-old or you've ever had a 16-year-old, you know nothing's more important than How is this relevant? How am I going to use this?
All right? I had to make this matter to them. And further, I wasn't going to have much of a class if I just presented them with a bunch of clear black and white kind of scenarios and case studies that anybody could say, well, that was horrible. Why do they do that? I wanted to find complexity. I wanted to find nuance. I wanted to present them with a situation that might look black and white, but upon closer inspection, they started asking questions and scratching their heads. I've gotten a lot this trimester of, well, I'd like to think that I do X, or I would hope that I would respond as Y. But they're starting to be aware that not all of these are that easy necessarily. I wanted to really blow up the idea of pure knee-jerk American exceptionalism. This is an exceptional country, no doubt. But any notion that this is a perfect country has no place in a classroom, an academic classroom. And so I wanted to really get at the heart of that and force them to ask hard questions. And most of all, I wanted to be proximate. I wanted this to be close. I wanted it to be geographically close. I wanted to present them with issues that happen in their own backyard. I wanted to give them young actors. I didn't want them to read about a bunch of old white men. I wanted them to read about people their age and just a little bit older, learn about them. And I wanted to approach things that were still going on. I felt like that was really important. And I didn't want them to go home every day and want to jump off a bridge. All right? We've wrestled with some really hard stuff. I have thrown some case studies at them that will just devastate you. That you will wring your hands and shake your head and say, how could human beings do this to one another? But at the end of the day, I've got to have them walk out of there thinking, we can do something about this. We can make it better. If I haven't done that, then all I've done is depress a bunch of 16 and 17-year-olds. That's not accomplishing anything. And most of all, I wanted the entire course to be about action. I didn't want them writing essays and taking tests that just is between them and me. I wanted to charge them to take this and to take that out into the world. That to see themselves as change agents, which they have begun to do in quite an exciting way. Among the many, many, many human rights challenges in the history of our country, I've chosen three that, frankly, I've bitten off more than I can chew. The next time I do this, I'm going to have to cut back a little bit. I thought I was being reasonable, but I probably wasn't. First thing I wanted them to look at was interaction between the United States government and the Comanche and Kiowa people in Texas, on the plains, in the panhandle, in the 1860s and 70s. We did some brief background on the Trail of Tears. Clearly, you can go to any part of this country and do indigenous nation work. Okay, but I wanted this in their backyard. I wanted them to know they could drive an hour from here and find the site of a massacre. It needed to be local. I tackled the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, which to these kids may as well be the medieval period. I mean, really, it's amazing. This is forever ago today. I mean, these kids were barely born on 9/11, okay, to give you some perspective of what we're dealing with. And then I wanted to tackle the LGBT revolution of today, because I wanted them to see that they are in the midst of social change. Social change and revolution is not just something that happened once upon a time. They're in the midst of it. And even though they were born around 9/11, they have watched this from the time they got to middle school just rocket forward in ways that nobody could have predicted. So I've chosen these three case studies as what we're going to attack. And the way we do our assessments, our projects, is that they have three projects that they can work in whatever order they want to. And I call them teach outreach, because I want them teaching and reaching out to other people. They've got to take what they learn out into the world. They are not writing to me. They are working with others.
So one of the assignments they've got to execute is an essay that they will then give to somebody that they do not, that is not in our class. Another is to create a teaching experience or lesson that is designed to enlighten and challenge a group of people, a target audience. Some of them took this to their houses of worship and did Sunday school lessons or Saturday school lessons. Some of these kids tried to talk their history teachers at Green Hill into letting them do a lesson. Some of them wrote letters to their congresspeople. They designed all sorts of lessons. They put public service announcements on YouTube. But they're taking something they've learned and they're teaching it out. And then the last is what I call a little tweak. It's a preach outreach. If you've ever listened to this, I believe, on NPR, they are short 400 to 600 word essays where somebody just says what he believes or what she believes. I worry, and I feel like a grumpy old man saying this, but I worry that our kids don't often enough have the experience of standing and saying what they believe. Not sitting in a class and saying, well, you know, I think. Or, well, how about this? But the experience of standing up and saying, I believe. Mm-hmm. That's a really important experience for a kid to have. And hopefully, that kid doesn't stand on that belief forever. Hopefully, that kid realizes that if you're a smart, learning human being, your belief is constantly evolving. But it's a chance for them to make a stand and to say something that's really important to you. I've done this in other classes before, and it's life-shaping for these kids. They come back to me 10 years later and talk about the This I Believe project. Now that it's focused on a human rights issue, I'm very excited. So just very quickly, to give you an idea of some of the things that we do, and if you are ever looking for a bibliography, I've got some great stuff that I can show you. But one of the challenges that I throw at them with our Native American issues is who gets to write history? What is history? Is there a history of anything? It's all about the voices. And there's this wonderful, if anybody has ever been up in Stennett, up in the Panhandle, where Adobe Walls is. Adobe Walls was a Buffalo High trading post back in the 1860s and 70s. And it ended up being, for all practical purposes, the last stand of the Comanche, Kiowa, and a lot of the Plains Nations. Where, what's that?
76.
Yeah, they got together and they decided to raid this trading post. It actually was coordinated. It's a fascinating story. But I found this wonderful quote from a Texas historian who's writing to a gentleman who was there 49 years after the event, asking him for his version. Now, if I asked any of you to tell me the story of something that happened 49 years ago, would you bet your life on the accuracy of its details? I would hope. I'm getting some nods here. I wouldn't bet my life on the accuracy of anything. And I had an amazing experience when, as David shared with you, when Green Hill turned 50, my brother and I had a three-year project where we wrote the history of Green Hill. And that was such an enlightening experience to me because I would interview multiple people who were at the same event and they would give me different stories of what happened. And what was really interesting was when I had been there too. And I had my own memory of what had happened. So I'm hearing this person's version, and I'm having to filter it through my version. So if any of us, or our 16 and 17-year-olds, think that history is some absolute truth, I've got to disabuse them of that quickly. So these two pretty straightforward histories are fabulous. Empire of the Summer Moon, actually I think might have won a National Book Award, or it was a finalist. It is about Juana Parker and the Comanche people. The Conquest of Texas, Ethnic Cleansing in the Promised Land is a fascinating read about the U.S. government's interaction with the Comanche and Kiowa people. This writer falls on the scale that it actually was an ethnic cleansing and not a genocide. But if you read explicit United States government policy about the Comanche people and the Kiowa people, it will turn your stomach. So, we explore these things. America's very creation myth, the whole idea of manifest destiny. If you're familiar with Frederick Jackson Turner's Frontier Thesis, he writes about this amazing, uniquely American phenomenon. It's going to take 1,000 years to cover the continent from east to west, when in fact we did it in a whole lot faster than that. And he writes about what is uniquely American is the fact that there was all this free land. Free land. Okay? There were a whole lot of people there who might beg to differ with the assessment of that as free land. But it's in our DNA. It's part of our creation myth. Manifest destiny. It's really important that kids see this. Not to destroy their love of country, but to deepen their love. There's a wonderful book over here that's actually a horrific book. It's called, it's Will Barter's Depredations, Indian Depredations in Texas. This guy, about 1900, 1910, maybe, collected stories of every white Indian conflict over about a 150-year period. And he wrote them down, okay, as history. Now you start reading these, and you look at the language that's in there, the use of the word savage, the use of the word uncivilized. It's always the Native American people persecuting the white people in here, regardless of what the body count is or who started it. Really fascinating to read his accounts. And one of them is the story of Cynthia Ann Parker. Anybody in here know the story of Cynthia Ann Parker? Cynthia Ann Parker, little girl in East Texas, Parker's Fort, her family has settled out there, and a group of Comanches come in one day and murder her parents and a couple of aunts and uncles, and take Cynthia Ann and her brother and kidnap them. Okay, and they head for the hills. They head for the Llano Estacado. Charles Goodnight, actually the old man of the plains, among others, follows them. But if you were following the Comanche and you got out on the high plains, they knew where the water was and you didn't. So you didn't go there, especially if you had a small posse. So Goodnight actually turns around and Cynthia Ann settles in with the Comanche. 30 years later, she is now the mother of Quanah Parker by Peter Nakona, who is the war chief of that Quahati band. 30 years later, the U.S. cavalry is traipsing around in North Texas, and they come upon a settlement of teepees, and they decide to raid. A decision that's made all the more exciting when they realize that all the warriors are gone hunting buffalo. So all they've got to raid is a bunch of women and children. So they raid, they kill all the women and children, except this one blue-eyed woman that they're kind of curious about. And they take the blue-eyed woman back with them. We had a great discussion as to General Sol Ross, whether his motive was a war prize, whether his motive was to return a child to her family, or whether his motive was, surely her life would be better with white people than it was with Comanche people. Regardless, they take her back, they find some of her extended family, they return her to that family. She hates it. She won't eat. She won't talk. She's miserable. Her people are now the Comanche people. Now, what better wrestling with the idea of identity for 16 and 17-year-old kids for whom that's everything, than an issue like this, right? If you read Will Barger's version of it, you're going to get a very different story. When the kids start talking it through, they see it in very different terms. N. Scott Momaday is a Kiowa writer. We read his three plays over here. Absolutely extraordinary versions of stories from the Kiowa schools. and Colonel Pratt's school at Carlisle, where Jim Thorpe attended. Actually, one of the plays is about Jim Thorpe and Carlisle Indian School playing West Point, whose star player happened to be Dwight Eisenhower. These are all based on fact, but they're historical drama. And Pratt and the Indian school administrators' mantra was, kill the Indian, save the man. Destroy their culture, take away their clothes, cut their hair, refuse to let them speak their language. Punish them if they worship the way they want to worship. The eyes get big when we're used to it. And they realize that it's all about the voices. Whose voice are we hearing when we're studying these things? And the other thing that I came across that was fascinating to me is when you talk to teenagers these days, their sense of American Indian, of Native American, is that this is a people that exists in the past. These are like knights. These are like shepherds. They don't really exist anymore.
Yeah, they do.
And when they start learning about the American Indian movement, when they start learning about Alcatraz, I went to San Francisco, I've been to San Francisco 20 times. Last year I decided to take the Alcatraz tour. I had no idea. If you don't know the story of Alcatraz and the role of Alcatraz in 69 to 71 in the American Indian movement, go home and Google it. Really, really important. And if you've never been to the National Museum of the American Indian at the Smithsonian, I strongly recommend it. These are nations and cultures that are still thriving. They are at the bottom of our socioeconomic ladder, but these people are still around. These are not extinct species. Paul Schott Smith has a really, really fantastic anthology of essays. Everything you know about Indians is wrong. Then we transition into the civil rights movement. There's a lot of talk these days at the university level about trigger warnings. You tip kids off that we're going to talk about hard things before you dive into them, and you give them the opportunity to opt out. I call BS on that. Kids, if they're in an academic classroom, need to roll up their sleeves and wrestle with hard stuff. Now, the only exception I will make to that is when we look at lynching photographs. Because I think a photograph is a different animal than reading an account. So there is a website and an amazing book called Without Sanctuary of lynching photographs. And I don't know if you're aware, but many lynching photographs were turned into postcards. And they were mailed around as if they were souvenirs. So this one here... This gentleman was hung in Center, Texas, and this person wrote the postcard. This was made in the courtyard in Center, Texas. It is a 16-year-old black boy. He killed Earl's grandma. She was Florence's mother. Give this to Bird from Aunt Myrtle. This went through the U.S. mail. That, right there, went through the U.S. mail. There are hundreds of these lynchings, hundreds of these photographs. Snake actually decided to turn it on his head in the early 60s. But before we dive into a lot of the victories of the 50s and 60s in the movement, the kids need some sort of sense of the context of what was going on before this. I will never forget in November of 2008, when on election night, I am weeping as the returns are coming in, and my son is looking at me like I'm crazy. Like, what's the big deal? I said, you do not understand. He could not understand. But you start looking at some of these pictures, and you get a little bit of context. What so much of this boils down to is fear of the other, and fear in a zero-sum game that for you to have something, I've got to give up something. This is an extraordinary cartoon about miscegenation, and it starts off with a PTA member, white mother, at mixed race meeting,
Why my children go to school with the Negroes, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. A few years later, in school, they get along well. Public equals government schools. They have classes in high school together. Uh-oh. Now the African-American young man is calling on your daughter. Now he's marrying your daughter. That was fast, from panel 4 to 5. Okay? Now, you've got grandchildren. We may not completely understand the genetics of this. We've got one black kid and one white kid. Okay? Now, Uncle George and Aunt Mary, you thought this could never happen. Uh-oh. Then the kid comes up to you, hello, Grandpa. Anyway, this is fear about what could happen. Fear, fear, fear. We start every class period singing freedom songs. I have a good friend of mine who is a gospel singer, and I got her to come in and train us how to sing the freedom songs, and every day we are singing, "We Shall Overcome," "Buses Are Coming," "Guide My Feet." It is so cool to see 16 and 17 year old kids who are too cool for school singing these songs and marching and clapping around the classroom. And really, in this unit, my focus is on the young people. The fact that this movement had its energy in 18, 19, 20, 21, 22-year-olds. Diane Nash, James Meredith, Elizabeth Eckford of the Little Rock Nine, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. This movement was run by young people. And I'm doing something I never thought I would do. And I'm actually liking it. John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, has just published a trilogy of graphic novels. Actually, I guess they're not novels because they're technically supposed to be memoir/histories. But they're in the graphic novel format. If you're not familiar with what that is, it's comic strips.
Comic book.
It's like a comic book. Okay? Here's John Lewis crossing Edmund Pettus Bridge as a 19-year-old, I believe, and teaching history through this genre has been fascinating because I wasn't sure that the images could quite evoke the same horror and fear and desolation. And I'm sure you can't get that from over here, but this is one of the buses, I believe, in Anniston being surrounded. The graphic novel format has come and gone. Wouldn't do it all that way, but I'm intrigued. And then the LGBT revolution, they have a hard time believing that until 1973, homosexuality was considered a mental illness. We reviewed a public service announcement put together by the police department in Inglewood, California, called Boys Beware. You watch this, and the analogy that's set up is gay man equals predator. The kids were laughing in this with this uncomfortable, you've got to be kidding me, did people really think this? And then as it kept going, they moved from uncomfortable laughter to outright horror. We talk about the role of literature and film. Annie Proulx wrote this little novella, 33-page story, called Brokeback Mountain. It is a gut-wrenchingly beautiful story. It's part of her Wyoming story collection. It was turned into a movie, I want to say in 2005. And that movie, particularly given these two actors, key role by Ang Lee, really changed the way a lot of people were willing to view homosexuality. And turning the American icon upside down. It wasn't just a teacher, a professor, a doctor who was gay. These are cowboys, ladies and gentlemen. This really, really flipped the vector on that.
The Laramie Project, if you're not familiar with the play that describes the story, the murder of Matthew Shepard at the University of Wyoming, it is a gut punch story. We actually produced it. We put it on at Green Hill in 2002, and it was the most amazing conversation story. So here, this is all obviously literature. This is not hard history reading. This is literature. But if you think about what's happened in the last 10 or 15 years, it's the arts that have really created a lot of this progress that's been made. Obviously, the watershed moment a couple of summers back. And then I will quickly, because I know we're running out of time, my other class is a social justice pilgrimage through poetry. And I'm gonna pass out some poems. I think there's enough for everybody to grab some of these. I did not grow up loving poetry. I have become an absolute lover of poetry. I decided that what I wanted to do with poetry was create my own anthology, and I wanted to play with it technologically. So I spent about 2 years finding every poem I could get my hands on that had any sort of human rights issue. And I boil it down to 100 greatest hits. I put them in different categories. And then I decided, well, actually here, in this class, the kids do a lot of writing. I have them take different photographs of human rights issues. This is a sonnet on Selma. There's John Lewis. There's another one on the Montgomery bus boycott. Really, really excellent poems the kids have written. But these poems that I'm passing around allow me, what I did was you used QR codes. By placing QR codes with a lot of the poems, I can launch the kids out to other places. So for instance, this one, you may remember Jasper, Texas, and the dragging murder that happened there in 1998. If you have a QR code, and I think it's on the sheet that I gave you, if you have a QR code reader, which all of my kids have, you just click on that, and it will take you to the Dallas Morning News story about that day. All right? I also have, you can launch out to a Woody Guthrie song. You can launch out to different paintings that a lot of these poems were inspired by. So it allows me to send the kids out further than just the poems that they read. And you know what? I think I'm going to stop. That's it.
So question for Perryman, and like I say, kind of, you know, be succinct, you know, as a question, don't get into a tirade. Yes.
Okay, looking at the photos on your social justice. Yep. Okay, thank you. And looking at the photos on your social justice, I didn't see a photograph of Malcolm X. Yeah, he was an intelligent man, fiery speaker. And I'm wondering if your students had the opportunity to hear his speeches.
Yes. Any study of the civil rights, you're going to have to make some difficult decisions about what to have in and what to have out. What I have found is that the kids are more interested in studying the Kings, the Abernathys, but I will whet their appetite with some background about Malcolm, and a lot of them will do teach outreach projects on that, so they will go. They will use that as a leap out. What I think these students have been most fascinated by, in just about anything we covered, is the nonviolent discipline. We went to the KingCenter.org and really studied the principles of nonviolence. which obviously come from Gandhi and come from Jesus. And many of the people in the movement were trained at the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee. These kids are fascinated by the discipline that it took for these marchers not to fight back. It is palpable. They're just amazement at that. So it's kind of interesting that the nonviolent aspect has, 10 years ago, I think Malcolm X was a more exciting character for a lot of the students. These guys seem more fascinated by the nonviolent aspect.
I think that you're alluding to it, intimating it already, but my question is, I assume that you're assume, that's a bad word, are you dealing with the aberrations that are frequently a phenomenon of social justice movements?
Aberrations as in mistakes,
aberrations
as in...
like really going off the deep end and, you know, immediately what comes to mind is the Black Panthers, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, there is no doubt, as I said earlier, that I've bitten off more than I can chew. I have so much I want to share with them, and I realize a trimester cannot get that done. But for instance, I don't know that I'd call this an aberration, but one of the things that we really wrestled with was the inclination in Native American issues to make the U.S. government the bad guys, and the Comanche and Kiowa the good guy victims. Okay? There's no doubt that there's a power imbalance. No doubt. But there's also no excusing the atrocities that were committed by the Comanche and Kiowa on the U.S. Army, on innocent settlers. Innocent settlers, as they came squatting on my land. But also on other indigenous nations. And so we really wrestle with the fact that this is nuanced. You can't just say good guys and bad guys. And then we wrestle with the fact that the United States Army in the 1860s and 70s were operating under the Libra Code, the rules of war. The Comanche and Kiowa didn't sign off on that. So are they beholden to a set of rules and conventions that they were not a part of discussion? So there's a lot of nuance, and I don't think anybody comes away from this class feeling like rattling cages is all going to be this uninterrupted progress vector. That certainly is not the case.
Two questions. Is Lionel Peltier a hero or a villain?
Okay, you just stumped me with a name.
Leonard Peltier was part of the American Indian Movement.
Oh,
he's held in federal prison right now.
Yeah. I do not know much about him.
That's okay. The second question is, do you think that a class about social justice works as well in a school like Reno, where there's obviously higher socioeconomic students there than it would in a classroom where you were dealing with people who are children of those who have been downtrodden?
I think you would be surprised at Green Hill's composition. Green Hill is racially, socioeconomically, religiously, geographically, internationally, pretty diverse. So it's not a rich kid school, which isn't to say there aren't rich kids.
I just assume this is the third most expensive school in Dallas. I'm not aiming it to be funny or be sarcastic at all.
The third or fourth most expensive school in town. But our commitment to financial aid is unparalleled in the area. And so we don't want a classroom where you've just got privileged kids wrestling with this.
Oh, no, I didn't think that. But do you think, though, that a class like this would go over, you have similar results in the class where you were dealing with kids that were not very well off, like in border parts of the city?
I don't know. I can't say. I have kids in my class whose parents and grandparents were African American in the South during the 50s and 60s, and dealt with a lot of the racism. One young woman whose parents were not allowed to get married until they moved out of Alabama. I've got quite a few gay kids in the class, so I think I have no idea how this would translate to another setting. But what I will say is, I don't think I could touch a lot of these topics in my school. So I don't. There's no. When I talk to colleagues in public schools, there's no way this class goes. No way. So I don't know. I can't answer that.
That's just what I was thinking about. How would this go over in public schools? I don't even know how that would.
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, I don't have a very well formulated question, and you can pull whatever way you think. The idea of accountability and guidelines and enforceability seems like a really important issue. I'm thinking about how we got involved in Iraq, and it turned out to be pretty much a disaster for millions of people for decades. The U.S. is not part of the International Criminal Court at The Hague, right?
Okay, that's correct.
So, would you speculate on where we're going as far as our leaders being held accountable and whether or not we could maybe avoid some of these disasters if they were?
This is one of the questions where I think the idea of American exceptionalism really gets called into question. Because we thump our bully pulpit self-righteously all over the globe. And yet we want to frequently stay out of situations to where we might get judged in return. What's the recent issue about lawsuits, being able to sue a nation where a terrorist came from? I mean, what goes out is going to come back. And we have not recognized that as a country as often as I wish we would.
Well, just as a quick follow-up, it seems like a lot of the most difficult problems we have aren't getting solved because of the sovereignty of nations. And the idea that we could stand above them and not be held accountable is part of sovereignty. And so what we really need is a world government. That's not a real popular notion, I imagine, but it's the future, and that's my opinion.
The sovereignty issue was fascinating during our unit of the Native American U.S. government conflict, because the U.S. government and the Army could not get through its head that one Indian wasn't the same as another, and that this tribe, this nation, might sign a treaty, but that doesn't mean when you come upon this village over here that there's another nation, that it's going to honor that treaty. It wasn't part of it. Even within a nation, even within the Kiowa people or the Comanche people, these bands operated pretty autonomously. And so the U.S. government was trying to view things in a more monolithic fashion, and it just was not working whatsoever. But the conversation we got in as a class was, okay, forget the rules your enemy fights by. If you yourself profess a set of rules, the Lever Code, which comes out of the Civil War, for the conduct of the United States Army. Doesn't matter if the other guys aren't fighting by those rules. You've got to fight by those rules. Otherwise, why have the rules? And this was a really perplexing issue for these kids. And what ended up happening was they brought it down to their own personal situations that mom and dad tell me the rules are X. All my friends have the rules Y. Mom and dad expect me to operate by X, and it doesn't matter what the school's rules are, it doesn't matter what any other rules are. If mom and dad expect me to do A, B, and C, I've got to do A, B, and C. And that idea of sovereignty is a really tricky issue. It's so applicable. I mean, the kids were like, oh my God, this is what's going on in the Middle East. Yeah. the era of fighting sovereign nation may be gone. And that changes the rules dramatically.
Kill that to Putin.
Let's hope these sovereign nations don't get into it.
I had an incident last week. I had visitors in town and we went to lunch at North Park and walked around with the yard. We came across a bulletin board, and I can't remember the exact wording on it. It was something like, what would you wish for this nation? Some question like that. And you could pick a sticky note, write it on, and put it up. And I maybe got 100 of them up there. And I'd say the overwhelming number, maybe only except for two or three, there were answers like fairness and justice for all, everyone with enough to eat, education for everybody, on and on and on with those kinds of statements. And it just hit me. I said, well, if this is what the majority of us want, why aren't we getting this? Have your children been to that board that goes to something like that, or have you thought about doing something like that in the class in a second? If we want this as a people, why
don't
we do
this? They're outraged by that. I think, and one of the reasons why I do this, is I think our young people need to be empowered. They need to see themselves as agents. That they are not being acted upon, they can act. And that's why I show them. Diane Nash, John Lewis, and James Meredith. These were 20-year-olds who changed the world. And so we don't have to wait on the government. We don't have to wait on the old folks. Young folks need to feel like they can make that difference. Because this generation is more passionate about social justice issues than any I've taught in the last 30 years. There is an absolutely marked difference in these folks. I mean, they weep in class. They get angry in class. This is not an academic exercise. This is important to them. Now, are we going to go from, can we make the step from the yellow sticky notes on the wall to actually making a difference? I will say that I'm hopeful.
I'd like to ask a question if I may. It's important, of course, that you've shown them how peaceful marches, civil disobedience a la Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. have gotten such great dramatic results. From the mighty British Empire to America. But it seems to me that there's a gradation from peaceful marching to rocks and tear gas to looting and arson and murder on downtown Dallas. Where do you draw the line? So I'd like you to talk about that.
Well, I think that it's easy to be a social justice activist in a classroom. And anybody with a heart can be angry or sad. But it takes going out and putting something at risk. Dr. King's statement is something along the lines of, if a man hasn't found something for which he's willing to die, he's not fit to live. Now, can all of us, or any of us in this room, look ourselves in the mirror and say there's something that we'd be willing to die for, other than family? An idea that you're willing to die for. Because these folks were willing to die. Change doesn't happen because you're angry. Change happens because you're willing to walk into the lion's den. And so I can get up here in my bullet pulpit and teach these kids all this kind of stuff, but I haven't been beaten with a billy club. And so that discipline of nonviolence, I personally agree with, and I think it is remarkable in its power, but it makes no sense to do that if you're not willing to get the snot beaten out of
it. I would just
I don't know what incident you're thinking of, but I would challenge your assumption that there's been any riots or rock throwing in downtown Dallas. I've been to those protests. They've all been peaceful.
Well, there's other places where they have.
That was a peaceful protest.
Yeah, the police were killed.
Yes, but that was not the organizers doing that.
I'm not.
That was a madman.
Okay.
And that was not the part of organized effort. That was an individual. So I would just challenge that assumption.
I think there is, I mean, clearly, there is rage in this country. There are people who are angry. And there are people who are justifiably angry. I'm not aware of situations where people have gone from this kind of movement and crossed that line. Certainly it happened in, you know, Watson and places like this in the 60s, and there are other incidents. But I don't think that's what we're seeing now. I think that's different. Yeah.
Well, yes, you've got a very solid connection between historical events that kids can really latch on to. I can see how that would really, you know, capture their imaginations. But what I wonder is, have you taken some time to provide like a theoretical underpinning for the idea of social justice, like maybe John Rawls's theories?
I have not.
Okay.
I have not. Right now, just this is taken. All I got. We have done some reading on the nonviolence idea, but that's about the extent of it. Yes?
Yes, I'd like to pick up with that further. Having dealt with courses and advocated nonviolence after being in the military, why do you think this generation is
I don't know, because in some ways I think this generation is almost inured to violence. There is almost a jaded, when you watch some of the games that they play, when you see what they see on TV, and I think it's easy to disconnect pulling a trigger from the fact that that person is never coming home for a lot of these kids. I don't think they understand violence. But there just seems to be a different fascination. Now, my kids aren't saying, we're going to go out there and march into, you know, police lines. But there seems to be a fascination that wasn't there 10 years ago or 15 years ago, and I'm not sure exactly why, because they have more access to violence than any generation in the history of this species. I don't know.
My name is Michelle, and I just want to say thank you so much for what you're doing. Can you hear me? I just want to say thank you so much for what you're doing with this class. I actually took Rick Halpern's class at SMU when I was a senior in college, and I didn't know what the heck I wanted to do. I thought I wanted to do zoology. And it ended up, my boyfriend got me in the class, and it really changed my life. And now I'm working for the International Rescue Committee, helping refugees resettle in Dallas. But I wanted to say, how long is the position? I don't know if I mentioned, or if you mentioned that already. How long have you been teaching your course?
How long have I been teaching the course? Since August 24th.
And then, okay, so my next question would be, I think it would be really interesting to see where your students go, if they've been inspired. I was going to see if they've studied any of the material. Yes, but anyway, my point is thank you, and I hope it inspires people to go on and work in the
life. Well, thank you. That is my hope. I will say this, though it hasn't been these specifically human rights focus classes, I have for years found ways to integrate different service and social justice action into other projects. So for instance, in my poetry class for the last 20 years, One of the things I want them to get out of the experience is how hard it is to write a good poem. But how you can put, by caring about every word, nothing happens by accident, how you can really evoke feelings, how you can really change ideas. And so one of the projects that I've had kids doing for years is they have to think of something that they care about, and they have to write two poems in the service of that idea, and they have to do two other art projects that go together with that. So they can do sculpture, they can make a video, they can write a song, they can do an interpretive dance, they can do whatever they want to. But then they have to find an agency that works with that idea, and they've got to send their work out into the world. And I will say that for the past 20 years, the stuff that's been coming back from agencies, the gratitude, the paintings that are hanging on walls, the poems that are on websites, is really goosebump kind of stuff. So are these kids going to end up in the Embry Human Rights Program? I don't know. Are they going to end up, prosecuting cases at The Hague? I don't know. But I kind of think this is going to be part of who they are going forward. And that really excites me. Because no matter what they do, I want them to care. And I want them to think critically about what it is they're caring about. That it's not just a knee-jerk thing, but that they're really using their intellect to do that.
I too want to applaud you for what you're doing. As to an earlier remark about whether your class would be better in another part of the city than it is in your place, I kind of think it's a shame that BISC or whatever school would find what you're doing to be something that's not allowed. I don't understand that. I think this democracy that we have depends on more than the arithmetic, reading and writing. I think it depends upon thinking and thought and compassion and all these other things. I think it was Judge Souter who recently said that will be the demise of our democracy, is the dumbing down of the ignorance of the people. And I think it's clearly, it's a scary time that there possibly is. We're living in a time like that. Now,
Can I make a quick comment just to that? This is not just a problem with our public schools. Our peer independent schools, the other expensive schools out there, most of them won't touch it for a variety of reasons. Some of them are religiously affiliated. They don't want anything to do with it. Some of them just, this isn't in their DNA. It's our core values are honor, respect, and compassion. That runs through every slide I had up there. So nobody's going to fight with me about it. I've got it really good, but I absolutely agree with you. This is a no-brainer. This is not, I'm not inventing anything brilliant. This could be done everywhere.
So my question is, isn't climate change critical to your students? I mean, it seems like that is the passion of the young generation.
Climate change? Yes. Absolutely. I have not found it quite as invigorating in terms of a lot of the stories yet. Maybe 10 years from now, it will be.
That might be too late.
Well, you're right. You're right. I will say, yeah, you're right.
I have a pedagogical question. Where did you get the source material and structure for this class? If you're the only one doing it, where did you go for inspiration?
Well, I mean, Rick Halperin in the program at SMU has tons of stuff. And then, it's this experience for me, this journey that Skip originally asked me to talk about, what it has been is, it's been a process of the scales falling away from my eyes, where I see it everywhere. Everywhere. The first couple of years, I was really having a dig. Now I can't turn around without finding amazing poems, without finding photographs, without finding TED Talks, without finding videos. It's everywhere. But you've got to somehow or another have that first awareness, and then you see it everywhere. And now more and more, the Library of Congress has amazing archives that you can find primary documents. I mean, there's...
But was it your idea to have these
students? Well, let's have somebody else have a question.
Please. Singing, I love singing, and I'm not a good singer, but that was actually part of a one or two classes at SMU, and I thought, I'll make that a discipline, a way to start every class. They love it.
Yes, sir. The
three projects that the kids do, I call teach outreach. So they're having experiences. They're not writing essays that they turn into me. They're doing three different experiences, the last of which I playfully call preach outreach, because they're going to stand up and deliver what they believe.
Okay, so you feel like you're creating a generation of communicators, people that are going to go out and be a conduit to disseminate information, possibly?
Absolutely. I have to be careful about getting theological in my classes, but my charge to these kids is they are not to keep their lights under a bushel basket, that they are to be out there. Communication is a big part of what we do at Green Hill. If a kid graduates from Green Hill, she can write, he can public speak. That's part of what we do. So the expectation is that it is going out.
Yeah, and that brings me to a question. Do you believe that it's important to equip these kids to be prepared to be targeted? Like you mentioned before, that they would be individuals that really believe that they were going to die for the reason. Do you believe that it's important to equip them to be prepared for things like that?
To be prepared to possibly be targeted?
Yes.
Yes. I try to keep them from being naive about their being on fire. We're all going to hold hands and cheer each other on in this class, but once you walk off this campus, there are no guarantees. What they're telling me from college, and then with these other projects, is they feel empowered to be leaders when they go out. And that's really what I want them to do, is to take chances and be leaders, but be aware of the fact that not everybody's going to agree with what you say.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a concern for me. It's just something I see from my perspective. I was in Missoula back in 2008, and it was my job to seek out and find these key communicators and then try to modify their perception and disseminate information for you.
Absolutely. I expect them to do something with this.
Okay.
And communication is absolutely key. I'm trying to salt the mine. Okay. I can't be everywhere. I want them to be everywhere.
Right.
And then, you know, year after year, if we're sending more kids out there like this, I think we've got a fighting chance, because you've got to win the hearts. I mean, that's what you were trying to do. You've got to win the hearts. But you're going to get smacked in the face a few times in the process.
I'm sorry, but I have to. This is a very energizing and important subject. And, you know, you're welcome to talk to Mr. Perryman later, but they want to kick us out of here before 9 o'clock when they close the restaurant. So we're going to have to, unfortunately, shut this down. So thank you very much.
Thank you all.